Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Welcome. My name is Brenda Lanoff at the Brenda's Mindful Healing Show. I'm a intuitive practitioner, and I incorporate many different healing modalities and work with individuals on Skype, now Zoom, and phone, several countries in the world, and I love to provide sessions that are geared toward a person's individual, you know, their concerns. So the intent of this show is to reveal how energy healing, it's a complement, it's not a conflict with Western medicine. And anyone who wants to experience some, you know, unique and powerful ways to complement your current practices, if you are a patient, a healthcare professional, a holistic healer, or any individual looking for some transformation, I welcome you. Tonight, my guest is Robert Williams. I'm really looking forward to our conversation with Robert. I'm just going to mention here at the beginning that he has a book. He's an author of Love is the Power, Moving from Humanity, from Fear to Love. And I'm going to give you further information as to Robert. Robert's book, it really captures the vivid memories and near-death experiences. And he learned of various, and he was transfixed, I should say, with various near-death and out-of-body experiences, which he reveals within his book. And this all comes down to the purpose of humanity, and this is why I'm so excited to talk to Robert, and that is as to realize love. And Robert describes the love is the power. It's not about the search of, you know, love, romance, or otherwise, but it's rather of being love. At a young age, Robert had the ability to see auras and the capacity for being a clairvoyant. And he tuned into the natural world the way not many others have. In Love is the Power, he shares a valuable message, simple yet necessarily vast to its core. Robert is considered one of the world's foremost experts in subtle energy engineering and technology. Robert's an inventor, a musician, and educator. He lectures at leading universities and is an inventor and developer of quantum co-technology. In addition to teaching music at the university level, Robert recorded and has performed such artists as the Beach Boys, Paul Horn, and Charles Lloyd. So he's worked with prominent scientists, including Dr. William Tiller, Dr. Beverly Rubick, Dr. Rustam Roy, and Dr. Stuart Krasner. So thank you, Robert. You have quite a background. And I'm really pleased that you're able to come on, and I'm loving the topic here today. And I just thank you for sharing your information that's so desperately needed right now on Earth. So thank you, Robert, for coming
Brenda,
on.
Thank you, Brenda. It's a pleasure to be on your show. It really is. I've read your website, and your experiences are quite extraordinary as well, and so it's a privilege to be on your show and to be part of your audience and talking about the heart and talking about love.
Yes, and well, it's interesting. That definitely captured my attention, the heart, due to my own cardiac arrest and near-death experience. However, and not to compare, and that's not my intent, but I'm so fascinated. I was able to read as much as possible within the book that within your book here, and I'm so fascinated with your near-death experiences and the light that you you refer to within your experiences. So I know that you quoted that this is absolutely no doubt that we have enough people on this planet right now to make a difference. And I believe that that's true. I believe that we are at a turning point I'm excited about it. So your book is so timely, Robert. Can you tell me, you describe how at a very young age, again, how you have had the ability to see auras and be a clairvoyant. Can you sort of go back in that time and just sort of bring us through some highlights that you have mentioned within your book and that's led you to this journey so far?
Sure. You know, the clairvoyance is, it's interesting. And, I've had it my whole life and for a long, long time in my early years, I didn't make sense of it. I couldn't understand it. So I discounted it. Now, clairvoyance is almost like peripheral vision. So we've all kind of played those games at some point when we learned about the eye, our physical eyes. We look straight, and we have those are our primary vision. So we're looking. But if you kind of like, without moving your eye, notice that your eye is also taking in the periphery. So I'm looking at, I have to confess, my computer and your website. I'm looking at your beautiful picture. You know, I can see that with my primary focus, but I can also see the side of my desk and the plant over here without moving my eye. So clairvoyance is kind of like that. It takes a little shift of attention to recognize these subtle activities. And like any good practitioner of an art, for instance, I have a good friend who's a dentist. He's a great dentist, really good, holistic dentistry. And when he looks at somebody, he is so knowledgeable about how the jaw, you know, the different ways a person's mouth looks, that he's not clairvoyant, but he can say, you know what, you've got some infection, or you have a crown that is out of place, or whatever, the jaw is out of, you know, you've got something going on. Doesn't mean he's special. It just means, well, it does and it doesn't. Doesn't mean that he's got a unique ability. It's just that he's practiced and practiced and practiced and looked at all the different, you know, and so now his specialty is to look at a person's whole body and identify what's going on with your teeth and dental issues. So like that.
Is he able to scan? Does he just mentally scan the body and track it to a particular area?
He doesn't admit it. He's just like, he's been studying just how a person's jaw and mouth looks for so many years that he can look and then see or deduce what's going on dentally. So like that, I have studied clairvoyance, and occasionally I will look and then be able to interpret what I'm seeing around a person or in a person or in a garden or, you know, out in space. But it took practice. It wasn't as if, oh, I looked at an aura, or I saw somebody's aura, and I knew what it meant. It was just, in the beginning, it was just a phenomenon, and I didn't understand it, which is a bit different than intuitions, you know? I think we all have those moments where we just know something, we're guided, we have our intuition on high alert for something. That's a knowingness. Those moments also came to me, but not through clairvoyance.
Okay.
Does that kind of give you an idea?
Well, yeah, interesting. But I definitely, the question I want to ask you right now, what was it about March 20th, 1979? Because I'm thinking, okay, what happened in 1979? Whether you were born or not, whether you were whatever you were doing, we experienced a 30-minute event.
Yes.
What is the 30-minute event?
The 30-minute, that's an approximation, by the way. That event is my way of describing what can be called a near-death experience. I was living in Santa Barbara. I'd been playing with the Beach Boys for about 3 years and became active in a production company for motion picture soundtracks and so forth. So I was in the entertainment business, and that was great, but I was also very sick and became more and more sick, more and more ill as the years progressed, and the doctors couldn't figure out what was going on. So there was one one epiphany that happened prior to the near-death experience, and that was when the doctors just said, look, if you keep continuing to degress and get sicker and sicker and your liver is inflamed and your kidneys don't work and your lungs are congested, and all these things were happening, they said, if I continued to go that direction, I would be dead in 6 months. So we've got to get you in the hospital, although they didn't know why I was so sick. So talking about intuition, I just felt, no, that's not my path. And common sense, you could say, my intellect is saying, well, they haven't been able to figure me out for the last 3 years. Why all of a sudden in the hospital with just more doctors and more equipment would I be able to heal up? So for better or worse, I decided not to go into the hospital and just released this fear that I wasn't ever going to get well. I still had the desire to get well, and I still had fear. But I, in a sense, kind of gave up my hysteria around trying to find out what was wrong with me, and I, in a sense, trusted. One morning I woke up, and I was stumbling to the bathroom, and I either, tell you the truth, Brenda, I don't remember this part, but I either passed out or I tripped and hit my head, because when I got back in my body, which I'll tell you about, there was blood on my, you know, there was a wound on my head. I was on my way to the bathroom, and the next thing I knew, I was looking at my body on the bathroom floor. So I was above, so to speak, looking, and I thought, how can this be? You know, what is the mechanism of sight if I'm not in my brain, if I'm not in my body? Who's the witness here? With a thought. But then I had the other thought. The next thought was, I'm dying, or I've died. And I was young at the time, didn't have my daughter, wasn't married, you know, didn't have too many attachments, to tell you the truth. And I thought, well, that's fine. I believed in higher dimensions, and I didn't believe that we only have one life and that's it. So maybe it was that belief that allowed the next experience, which was just complete light. I didn't go through a tunnel or anything like many of us have talked about with near-death experiences, seeing people that have passed on before us. Mine was just seeing my body on the bathroom floor and then total light. I say light because there's really no other word. It could be synonymous with complete love. Light, not like the sunlight or bulb, but just this freedom and bliss.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't recognize the freedom and bliss and pure love until I became just a little bit separated from it, which is an interesting reflection.
Okay, it is.
It was kind of like you wake up from a dream and then you go, oh, I just had this dream that was really nice, a good dream, let's say. So there was light, and then I became just a little bit separated from the light. And so then there's two things, right? There's the light, and then there's something perceiving the light. And you could say three things. Then there's this process of perception, which I learned about. So that was the moment where I gained recognition or gained consciousness of this brilliant reality, this brilliant substance and fundamental essence of everything. And that light didn't end. It wasn't like the sun. It just was everywhere. It's the substance of our own truth.
Okay.
There was a master that showed up, and whether I projected that mentally or whether he was real, I believe he was real. And there was a choice given to me. Do I go back to the light? Or do I go back to my body? I asked if I had a purpose. The answer was yes. It was kind of a gravity that at first I was feeling back to the light. I wanted that freedom again. I wanted that bliss. And hearing and understanding that I had a purpose to remain or go back to my body, then I said, of course, then okay, so be it. That's when I saw a bunch of different things. So you could say in my coming back to my body or descending, these are words that don't quite describe it. There's no ascension or descension, but you could say it that way if you want. There's this feeling of more and more substance around our subtle bodies, my subtle body. And then finally, awakening in my physical body once again and kind of, you know, wiggling my toes. And this was March 20th, 1979, the event. The experience of those times away from my body, and then maybe the most important experience was back in my body, hearing the sounds of the garden, hearing the sounds of the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
We lived in a beautiful place, Santa Barbara, the ocean, garden, the trees, the birds, those nature sounds. Not only hearing them, which I did with my physical ears, but understanding them in a way I could have never imagined. There is an intelligence that is governing. There's that light that has taken like a rainbow. So the rainbow is always there, right? Anywhere on Earth, there can be a rainbow. All you need is the right combination of water and sunlight or light and an environment. And then the rainbow, all the seven colors just appear, right? It's not like each time a rainbow is created, but each time in the right circumstances, you can see the rainbow. A rainbow is revealed. So like that, it was revealed to me this intelligence, this light that is the substance of our physicality. And so the birds were singing in an intelligent way, the intervals, the ocean sounds, the insects, it was all part of this amazing potential, this amazing the amazing intelligence of Earth. And what was even more profound was that I realized that same intelligence that was governing nature itself was governing my own heartbeat, was governing my breath now. Mm-hmm. It was breathing again. And if we think about it, you know, where do our bodies come from? They come from this earth. The elements are all the same, you know. I believe our spirits come from other dimensions, but there's a relationship that is sacred between our physical bodies and our spiritual bodies. And that sacredness, or the sacred connection, is via this intelligence, these frequencies or these codes of life that, you know, if we had to figure out how to keep our heart beating correctly, we couldn't do it. If we had to figure out how a cell is going to rejuvenate in our left knee right now, all these things are happening miraculously. I have a daughter to see like the stages within 9 months of all these different changes, sometimes minute by minute. The intelligence is built in to our very fabric. That's what I began to understand.
And it's interesting, and within your book, you're mentioning that during this time of Earth, things begin to effortlessly appear relative to our state of consciousness. So depending on where we are at this moment in time is our ability to perceive what is there, our ability to understand what, you know, our psychic abilities. But so when you say state of consciousness, what do you mean by state of consciousness?
Great question. Let's start with sleep state of consciousness. So we are pretty much unconscious when we're sleeping, deep sleep, right? There's no consciousness. So there's one. Then we have dream consciousness, dream state. We have dreams. Then we have waking state. But it doesn't just stop. It's not just one state in waking. Nor is it in dream or deep sleep, by the way. But there's various states of consciousness we can have in our waking state. So the example, we grow as consciousness. So we are infants, our consciousness is undifferentiated, we're not separated from our mothers or anybody or anything when we're born. And you know, brain researchers have seen this. There's no differentiation between an infant's brain waves and his or her mother's, which is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a break and there's a sense of I-ness. So our consciousness is growing, we could say, going through different phases. And
yeah.
then there's this, yeah, then consciousness takes certain directions, and that's part of the grand mystery. So in my case, it took the direction of learning about music. So my consciousness at first was just being able to play, was able to play a little bit on my saxophone, and then I got better and better and better. So I became more conscious of music, more conscious of my saxophone. That was my path. We all have our paths, and our consciousness is a co-creator along with our choice to explore different avenues of creation, co-creator, creative intelligence. No matter if we're a musician or no matter what we're doing, we are conscious. So what I talk about in the book and what I believe and see, like the rainbow is always there, and then once we have the consciousness of perception and the environment is also in the right way with the rain, let's say, and the sunlight, then the rainbow appears. It's a dualistic, it's the environment, water,
mm-hmm.
the rain, and the sun, and our own perception, our own consciousness. If we were in deep sleep, we wouldn't see a rainbow, we wouldn't see anything. If we were in dream state, we wouldn't see it. We are in waking state. We have the ability to see a certain spectrum of light, the seven colors of the rainbow. By the way, just as a really fascinating aside, there are historians that believe that a long time ago, humans could not see the color purple or the color blue. So the rainbow
wow.
consisted only of five colors because their consciousness had not evolved, their nervous systems
mm-hmm.
had not evolved to the point where they could see blue and purple.
That is interesting. How long ago was this discovery made? Does it give a time frame?
Yeah, like in the first or second century, because the color wasn't in any of the art, nor was it talked about.
Oh, interesting. And, of course, you could go back to the art galleries of that particular era, time frame, and, that's really fascinating.
Yeah, now before I get accused of fake news, I never really researched that. I heard about it, so I'm saying it. Let's just say
yeah.
it's a metaphor
okay.
because somebody's going
right.
to say, "Wait a minute, there's blue in second century."
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, we can see. We have the consciousness to see what we're seeing right now. If our consciousness expands, we will see and experience more, and that is, I believe, inevitable, and it has to do with the cycles of life, the seasons of life. We do not see a flowering garden in the dead of winter. It's just not the season for it. When springtime happens, then the flowers, that's the season for the blossoming. And so that's four seasons in one year. All species go through seasons and cycles and phases of evolution and phases of awakeness or phases of aliveness. Humans have gone through a long time of a certain kind of consciousness, a certain aspect of life, a certain reality that they've shared as humans. Now we're in a paradigm shift, and so the analogy of the stem of a rose, the green stem of a rose breaking down, and it literally breaks down. There's more chaos in the cells. Some of the cells
mm-hmm.
go down the side. There's a breaking down of that stem system to give way to the next phase of the rose, which is the flowering. And that's a huge transformation. And we remember the caterpillar to the butterfly. There's all kinds of examples. And the two things about those kind of transformations, the rate of change during the actual change from the stem to the flower or the caterpillar to the butterfly is sometimes 100 times that of the previous state. So there's the caterpillar life, and it's just crawling along, stable. The immune system of the caterpillar is functioning to keep the caterpillar of the caterpillar, and it's eating and, you know, doing its thing, and then something overtakes it. Laws of nature overtake it. And the caterpillar actually resists it. The immune system fights this change and tries to keep it in that state, but it can't. There's an overriding code, overriding frequency of a blueprint that says, your time is up as a caterpillar. Now it's time to go through this chrysalis stage and the formation into this butterfly. So humans are going through something very similar right now, Brenda.
I totally agree with you. We're going through major, major transition, and many people are just starting to wake up. And I believe for the empaths, the light workers, we've been aware of this for quite some time, and we're actually feeling quite bombarded with the energies that are coming through right now because we're on the front line, and it can be difficult. And I think one of the things I love about your book is that it really gives a further confirmation that we are going through these transitions, and there is more light, coming at the end of the tunnel. And this is all the, as you say, this the manifestation or the transition as to the caterpillar, as you're referring to. So I do want to go back to a moment here. I loved your story about Jing.
Mm-hmm.
And it just reminds me of when I was very, very young of having, I felt that I could see these little people running underneath my bed, and I could never talk about it. Then all of a sudden they disappeared. So when I read your chapter about Jing and chapters of how that this Jing was with you and then sort of he disappeared, I could really feel that sadness for you.
Jing was, I believe, a nature spirit,
mm-hmm.
and or nature being. They are all around us. Jing was special for various reasons. And so back to clairvoyance. So I did grow up seeing spinning things in the backyard and seeing different things that had different forms and different bodies, if you will. And
mm-hmm.
Jing was very special. He was more present. There was an exchange of information and you could say friendship and love. And he stayed with me through my childhood until I became around, I think, 11 or 12 years old. When puberty
yeah.
came on, I remember those hormonal changes. And Jing came to me and said, I can't see you anymore. And I was so like, what are you saying? Please don't leave me. And he just said, I have to.
Mm-hmm.
Time for you, just bid me farewell, and I've never seen him again. So two possibilities. One is that I imagined the whole thing, what my parents thought, and, who can say
uh-huh.
what's in the imagination, whether it's real or not. The other possibility is that he is real or he was real, and there are beings that are not perceived by physical light sources that you can even say in the category of our guides and angels,
mm-hmm.
whole conversation. So Jing, I believe he was real because of what he taught me. I was just a boy, and I remember him very distinctly leading me over to places in the garden, like a snail crawling along, and pointing at the snail and explaining, you could say telepathically. It wasn't like he had a voice and we were talking like this, but you could, with some kind of communication that I remember being distinctly from him and being heard by me. And he would say, notice how the snail, and notice how the shell is made, and notice how it matches all the other shells, but it's never the same. All these things that
mm-hmm.
I've read about since then, but he was teaching me for some reason. So when I was an early teenager, I went back and I remembered all the things that he, or most things that he showed me and taught me. and found them in textbooks. I go, oh, my God, I remember this from Jing. Of course, I couldn't say this to any of my teachers or parents, sister. They occasionally what I did, they just, oh, yeah, it's imagination, you know. Or
yeah.
Maybe you're crazy, you know. We don't want to hear too much more about that guy, Jing. But I believe he was real, and I believe we all have our guides. Whether we can see them or not, I know that we can feel them if we pay attention.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, we have our, and we just have to be, you know, it's being open, and I love the expression, you know, let go, let God, so it's just like letting go, and the guard, you know, our guards are allowing the guards to come down, and just being, you know, ready and willing to receive and perceive, you know, what is there, and allowing that information to come in, it just basically being open. Looking outside of the box, and your story as to Jing, and it was just, you know, it was just a little sad for me again because there was a time and place for Jing to be, you know, be in your life and to guide you, and then it was time to move on, and you did find a replacement for that with your music, so. Yeah, that's just a beautiful story.
I bet you if we had a show of hands in audience right now, how many of you have seen little, like you said, little people in and out of your bed? How many of you have had that memory or have memories of beings like that that are kind of shimmery, invisible-like? I bet you more than one I know would be raising their hand right now.
Do you think that? Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
When people are in a safe environment, I'm amazed at how many people admit to seeing celestial beings and
mm-hmm.
nature entities and spirits and whatever you call them, Davis. You know, very, very conventional scientists have said, well, I remember one time, you know.
Right.
We're approaching an age where it's more acceptable.
Yes.
Talk about these kind of experiences, just like it is more
yes.
acceptable to talk about meditation and yoga these days than it was in the
70s. Oh, we've come such a long ways. It is amazing, and thank goodness, and it is a great time to be here on Earth as to this time again, but it is a great time that we chose to be here. I do believe that, and now it's like we have this time, like an opportunity to really step out and shine, and you know, master our gifts and, you know, just be ourselves and being, feeling safe about that. Not we're going to be, you know, persecuted because of the way that we think and we're perceived by society, by our family. So I commend you for, again, for bringing this book out. And I love your, you know, paraphrases throughout the chapters. So tell me what happened after your nature spirit, after Jing. What was the next step in throughout your time, your evolution as after Jing?
Well, immediately afterwards, I just got very depressed,
mm-hmm.
and I was still able to see auras. By the way, it didn't stop the clairvoyance, but Jing was gone. And I would call for him and, you know, pray. Well, he just never showed back. So I was very sad. But there was a certain feeling around Jing that I was searching for, a certain safety, a certain zone. You know, we talk about being in the zone or being in a certain cool space of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I did find that replacement in a different way than nature spirit with my music. So I started playing saxophone when I was 7, so I've been playing for a while. And now I'm 12, 13, 14 years old, and, you know, I was playing still. But then there would be certain times where I'd be playing and I'd have that feeling again. Like, wow, you know, I was good enough on the sax. I wasn't really good, but I was good enough that I could start to just play and feel like something was playing through me, or the music was playing itself, and I was a witness to that. And, you know, just started to play different things improvisationally. And I had that same feeling, or a very similar feeling of that freedom, of that source of creativity that I had with Jing in out in nature. So, yeah, so then I became really, I couldn't wait to come home from school and practice my sax and join the bands and stuff. So that was my next phase of integrating the that state of consciousness that we all have, that freedom, that source of creativity.
How did your parents react to you as a child? I couldn't imagine.
Yeah.
When you were awake. And, oh, my goodness. Interesting.
Well, they were concerned many of the time, most of the time. But I also was secretive.
Yeah.
You know, I'd come home, or before school, I would just be in the backyard. We had a fenced-in backyard, so it was safe, you know, and I began digging and just being back there. So my mom didn't worry. And those were my times alone.
Yeah.
My sister is older, so she had her own world, 4 years older. But when I would report my experiences, certainly when I was young, you know, parents just rolled their eyes. Oh, it's just a child, you know, imagination. When I got it to be a teenager, then they became concerned. What are you seeing, Robert? Well, I see these things here and there, you know, out in the garden. Now I was too old to be imagining things. So I remember going to doctors, and this was the 50s, so maybe they have something these days, that brainwaves or whatever, but of course the doctors couldn't find anything, and I responded to all the basic procedures, you know, like reflexes, follow the pin with you know, with your eyes, and they, you know, can you look up and down, you know, does he have a brain tumor? No, okay. Well, they just said, you know, he's just a boy. That's odd. Just don't worry about it. So I think my parents got used to it, but I also got used to not sharing. And I was just a young boy with similar problems that other boys had, going to school and playing my saxophone and getting into trouble and stuff like the other kids. So I kept my clairvoyance secret, and
yeah.
I kept all the experience that I had previously secret, too. I did have a diary, though. I still have these diaries, and I talk about Jing and stuff. Still written when I was 9, 10, 11
wow.
years old. Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing.
I refer to my diaries in the writing of my book, just to get some clarification of, like, the day that I experienced this and that. There's a story in the book when I experienced psychic energy when I was in junior high, with a girl in my class. Remember that part? I wrote all about that in my diary, pages and pages, because it really affected me. So I'm not going to say it, because I want everybody to read the book and get their own opinions from these crazy stories.
Wow, interesting. I'm interested about the dimensions and how you describe your journaling the different dimensions. How did you perceive, or how did you feel, or how, tell me about the dimensions and how that came to you, working with dimensions.
Okay. Let's say we talked about dreaming, the dream state of consciousness. Let's say that we learned to remember our dreams and analyze them. People have
mm-hmm.
I never did it, by the way, but just as an example. It's one state of consciousness reflecting and doing a commentary on another state of consciousness. So when you're dreaming, there is, I'm with the exception of being aware in your dream, but when you're dreaming, you're usually just in that state. You don't know any other state. Then you wake up, and now you can go back. So going through the different dimensions was similar. I still do it, is similar. When there are portholes or doorways into our higher consciousness, or our more holistic consciousness. I don't like the term higher as opposed to lower, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They are more holistic. They're more of who we are. There are little doorways. A good example is when, if you're a writer, by the way, Brenda, and you're a creative person, I'm sure occasionally you've experienced writer's block. You know, there's something that's in the way, and you can't, things are not flowing. All of us have experienced that, no matter what, whether we're authors or not. There's like a block of our creative intelligence, our creative potential. And then there's a release, then there's something that happens suddenly, and whoa, we get these insights, or we get, you know, we start writing and it's just coming out, or we're composing. That's like the doorway, the little porthole to a higher dimension opens for hopefully more than a second. And that's what interdimensional travel does. It I've been able to identify those doorways. Here's the one of the secrets.
Yeah.
Usually the doorways are closed in areas that we resist the most.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say I'm afraid of public speaking, which I was. So there's two ways to deal with that. Just don't public speak, you know, and just my attention on other things besides, oh, I'm going to talk in front of my class, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Or, now this is the what I learned the hard way, but all right, just accept that fear of public speaking in this case. Just accept it. And
okay.
And the more I loved and just released myself into that resistance, the more, well, at first it's more difficult. The resistance increases or the fear increases and the body begins to shake, maybe. But if you keep going, then it just, you pop out of it, and then you're in a...
Okay.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting way of looking at it for anywhere that you have to sort of push out of your comfort zone. And public speaking is actually a very good example. So interesting. No, I love your analogy with that.
I will say that when I had the near-death experience, I lost my fear of death.
Mm.
Now, the body still has its program, like the caterpillar body. So, you know, it's like if I wanted to stop my breath, I couldn't. We're programmed. The body can't do it, you know. And if I wanted to make my heart, maybe I could learn to affect my heartbeat. But there's so many things that are ingrained that are automatic, and I don't have any power over that unless I violate the laws, right? But there is something that I learned after 1979 that I don't recommend anybody. But going into that fear of death, I was able to come up against that resistance to death that the body has. The body intelligence and the mind and the emotions are saying, do not pass, go. You know, go, do not pass this point of this boundary or this physical reality. I was able to breathe in a certain way and go past that and then pop out into a higher dimensional body, like seeing my body on the bathroom floor. So I began to do that many times, and when my time was up, as you could say, in these higher dimensions, learning different things, then my time was up. I didn't, you know, I had to go back, and it would be like somebody waking you up. You know, you resist like, oh, come on, you know, and then now you're awake, and that was hopefully a good thing. Mom wakes you up for breakfast. So we have those forces that kept me back, coming back to my body, and then I'd write it all down in my journal. I'd remember it. I'd do a commentary on it. I'd go back and ask more questions, and go back and forth like that.
How many near-death experiences have you had?
Well, you know, those experiences, people that were with me at the time said that my body would, you know, I would be sitting like in meditation or in prayer, and my body would become gray, and they'd come up, and they couldn't hear my breath, and they couldn't see my pulse. But you know what? I was not on a, you know, on a medical device. I don't know if my heart was beating really slow or whatever. So that happened many, many times. I mean, hundreds.
Okay. Really?
Over many years, for many years. The clinical near death, I've had a couple of those in the hospital, and those were different. That's when, you know, I had something stuck in my esophagus and I couldn't breathe. And those were more clinical, you know, where the heart actually
Okay.
observation of medical people. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, it was interesting. You know, with my near-death experience, I have no memory of really anything happening or traveling or looking down on my body, but I had truly had changed afterwards, and I was quite fearless. So I don't think you can return from a near-death experience without it radically changing you for, you know, forever.
Mm. Yeah, and you know, that fearless state is our natural state.
Okay.
And our I think those of us like you, Brenda, and many of us who have had the near-death experience, in a sense, we needed to be jarred. Maybe we were more stubborn, and we had to have such an experience to awaken that state of fearlessness. Because I have seen it in my own life, and I've seen it with many other people, that state of fearlessness, you know, and they're in that higher state of consciousness. For instance, the Dalai Lama, if anybody has been around him for a long time, for more than a few minutes, you feel this. He's like, he's in a different state of consciousness. He's overcome, I would say, most, if not all, of his fears. I didn't hear about his, you know, any near-death things. So he's been able to develop that he's been able to cultivate that reality. And that comes back to the season we are approaching, the blossoming of humanity. It's going to be a sudden thing. The chaos is here. It's obvious. We look at our political and economic systems around the world, not in every instance, but as a generality, there's a lot of breaking down. There's a lot of chaos. There's a lot of disorder. That's a sign.
Yeah, there is, and it's interesting because I know for myself, I'm becoming calmer, and I guess that's one of our roles is to help others that are in that chaos, but it certainly is out there, and you just have to walk out the street, and it can be just simply people driving erratically, and, you know, the just behavior and rudeness, and I mean, it just goes on and on, but it really is chaos. It'll be interesting to see what happens here in another. I'm just hoping it calms down here in another year or so, but I don't know. Who knows? I guess.
Well, you're radiating out calmness, and calmness is another expression for less fear, if not fearlessness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't mean, Brenda, for your listeners, and I, you know, it doesn't mean that if you were walking down the street and a tiger came running out of the woods at you or a car, you know, that you would just kind of allow your calmness to continue and then you get run over or beaten up. You know, you still have those intrinsic intelligent cells that say, uh-oh, get the heck out of the way now, and you'll react appropriately.
Definitely. I find I do alternate from tremendous anger to calmness, and I think a lot of us are picking up the energy of chaos, especially as empaths. So it could be that it's not your particular anger, but you're picking up on it and it's catching yourself like, oh, okay, perhaps this isn't mine, perhaps I'm picking up on more of a collective conscious level and learning to identify that it may not be yours at all, and just letting it go.
You want to see you want to see anger? Look at a mother whose child is being taken away.
Oh yeah.
You know, and that is anger. That is along with whatever it's going to take to protect the child. It makes me cry. I'm a father. So we talk about our Mother Earth, and we talk about tragedies and cruelty. It is built in that we know that that's not necessary. Certainly
mm-hmm.
not necessary. We know that life is not programmed with cruelty and even suffering. We know it. That's in our hearts. And when we see it happening and when we feel it happening, there is that mother's instinct to use that ferocity for the protection of our children and ourselves, actually.
Yes,
so
I'm
generalizing. You know, you can be angry and for the wrong reason or whatever, but I'm sensing your anger. Let's just say that. Your anger is coming from that anger of Mother Earth and what's going on.
Yes. Interesting. Yeah, very interesting. It is. That is picking up on a level that's totally beyond our consciousness. And like you say, it could be Mother Earth, just the sadness of what Mother Earth is experiencing. You know, we're getting close to the hour. I'm just enjoying this so much, but I do want to have you talk about here this quantum jump physics, call it. If you could get into the fear to love, healing the heart of humanity, and how you use the quantum co-technology. If you could discuss that and give some information on that, and how are you blending? How is this communicating, or how does this work as far as your beliefs and what you're portraying within your book? How is this helping us as human beings on Earth right now?
So you remember I just talked about going in and out of dimensions, you know,
mm-hmm.
and going to a source of intelligence, a source of creative information that was way beyond my mind. One of the things that I continued to see were mandalas or geometries, often called sacred geometries. And they're symbols. Now, musicians know that if you see five straight lines and a treble clef, you know, and some notes, musicians know, or most of us know, that that means there's something to do with music, right? So first level of consciousness is, oh, there's something to do with music there, even if you don't know notes. Then you learn, oh, that's a middle C. That's a symbol for middle C. And then at a certain state of consciousness, you glance at that and you hear the note. Then at a certain state of consciousness, you don't need the music. So those symbols that are all around us, that are considered sacred geometric positioning, they're in mandala forms usually. They're found in all the indigenous art, Cherokee art, Taoist art, Hindu art, Christian art. They are relationships, symbols, if you will. And the symbols are here to activate intelligence, to activate certain levels of consciousness. Back to the music. So if I am Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, I tap in to that creative place, a beautiful song comes out of me, right? And I've worked with Brian, so I know I've seen this.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing love. He's like Amadeus, you know, where he just would download an entire song, all the parts, my sax part, all the horn, the trumpet, the five voice harmonies. He had it all at once. And that's a phenomenon of reaching a higher state of himself, his potential. Then the people come running around and they write the music for Good Vibrations, let's say, or Serpent Safari.
Yeah.
So I'm saying that because these symbols are around us, and I began to study them and realize that they emit a frequency. They activate, say, silent music. So like in Brian's mine, he would look at a staff in the note C, and he'd hear the note C. And if he went a step further, he'd sing it. So there are codes, there's 108 of them, that have to do with information about a blossoming. Like there's codes for the actual rose bush that were latent, were passive at the seed level, or the sprout level, or the stem level, or the leaf level, but then become very active, like a blueprint, so that the previous state of stemness and green leafness and thornness gives way to the flowering. It follows a blueprint. We have a blueprint. Humans have a blueprint for our next highest level of existence. And that blueprint is evident in our hearts. It is something we feel and something we respond to. When we are resonating with love and we're in that state of consciousness, we begin to use that resonance to enhance not only who we are, but who our environment as a whole. Love amplifies love. And the state of consciousness of creativity and light amplifies creativity and light around us. So we're at that threshold where if we get enough people, or nature allows, or nature's call for enough people to recognize what I'm talking about, what you are all about, what your listeners are about, it is not about cruelty or hurting somebody or trying to get something because we don't think we have enough ourselves and all those lower states. It's not about that anymore. It is, we can live together without cruelty and suffering. We can't. This is an intuition that will become reality, and there's codes of information that are allowing us to even have that thought. And they're active now. They're in the environment, and they're in our bodies, and they're in our minds, and our emotions, and our spirits. So those are the 108 codes that through a lot of help and a lot of smart people, and by grace, I was able to serve with electronics and crystal oscillators and field generating devices, and we figured out how to get that those codes to be transmitted from a computer server to any cell phone. So that's one application. It's an app, so you can get it on your cell phone. And what happens when you download it from, let's say, the Apple Store or Google, is that these frequencies that are already active in nature come through your cell phone. So even if you're in a unnatural environment, the cell phone's not natural. You know, it didn't grow out of a garden. And if we're buildings and computers and TVs and stuff, these are different kinds of frequencies. Now we have life-supporting frequencies, these codes of blossoming life that are coming through your cell phone. And so that's quantum code technology. And it's available in the next couple of days on Apple and Google for $1.99, one time fee.
It's fabulous. And I know that I am going to be downloading this here as soon as possible and start using it. I understand what you're saying as to the codes and it's fantastic, and I do believe that by bringing this to the population, you know, more than 1% of the global population, if we're using this, it could be enough to turn the tide. And I have heard this previously, and for the fact that you're able to create this app, thank you. Firstly, thank you. That's fabulous. We need as much help as possible just to turn the tide. So what is the name of the app?
Name. Yeah, the Heart Plus app. So if you search it on Apple or Google, it's H-E-R-T and then the symbol plus.
Okay.
Like an ad sign or plus. So Heart Plus app, it'll show up. And the website is loveisthepower.com. You can get it there as well.
Loveisthepower.com.
Yeah,
loveisthepower.com. Okay, perfect.
And people can buy the book there if they want to.
Yes, no, that's fabulous. I just think it's a great blend. It really is. It's a perfect marriage is what I would say. So thank you. And your book, yeah, it was really, really touched me. Your story of Jane, you know, you're just your personal little stories, and you're very open and honest, and that's what we need, you know, for people to be authentic, and I believe you are. So I thank you for coming on. Let's just give your information out once again here for everybody, and how they is there any other further information to contact you, or is it how
my
do you...
own website is robertwilliams108.com. So the number is 108, and my name, Robert Williams.
108.com. Okay. Great.
And then, yeah, the loveisthepower.com has all kinds of other things on it as well. I think
okay.
That's on there somewhere. Yeah.
Oh, perfect. Okay.
Brenda, you are a light worker, and your audience is. And this is about us. The technology is ours. You know, I'm here in spite of myself.
Yeah.
And it's a collective thing we're doing, and we're joining together. So your service is so important, and I want to thank you for having me on your show and thanking all your listeners.
Yes, I do believe it's a collective effort, and what I'm finding more and more is that we need to support one another, and however you find your support groups, because it can get very heavy, and we are going through chaos, so the more that we can really feel that we can be ourselves, be authentic, share our stories is vital. So we have to find our tribes, our groups, who you resonate with, you know, communicate. So if it is communicating with yourself, whatever, find your tribe, find your people, and so that you remain strong and again, can move through this chaos and just feel supported and support others.
We're going to be okay. Yeah, absolutely. Beautifully said. And that we do need each other right now. Absolutely.
Thank you. I'm going to have this show, I'm going to be downloading it on my website, which is whisperingenergetic.ca. That's whisperingenergetic.ca. And I'll have it downloaded, and I will send it to you as well, Robert. And thanks once again. I'm excited about this app. And for anybody out there, I really recommend purchase the book. It's very moving, and I love the honesty. I love the fact that Robert's being so authentic, and he's given it all, and that's what we need. So thanks everybody for coming on tonight, and we'll be in touch, Robert. I'll be in contact with you here soon. So
yeah, I look forward to that. But thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you once again.
Yeah, thank you. Bye, everybody.